Welcome to Module 1 of the High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification Program. In this module, we're going to link together several aspects of school leadership that may seem like they're in competition with each other for your time. But over the course of this program, you'll see how they all fit together to create a system for instructional leadership. Nearly every school leader I've ever met wants to spend more time getting into classrooms and helping to improve instruction, but there's always so much else to do. Just the daily demands of running a school keep you busy all the time, so there's never extra time for anything that isn't required, like informal visits to classrooms. We know if we want to get into classrooms more, we have to make time, but it's tough. And then, of course, there are the mandatory aspects of instructional leadership, like teacher observations and formal evaluations, which take up dozens or even hundreds of hours a year for many administrators. Finally, in addition to evaluations and the operational demands of leading your school, you have the decision-making work that you do as an administrator. In my research, I've discovered that it's decision-making that ties the work of instructional leaders together. For too long, there's been a dichotomy in the way we talk about our work. We treat management as something unpleasant that we have to do, but that's not a good use of our time. Management work keeps us from getting to the real work, we think, the work of instructional leadership, where we know we can make a real impact. Because we can never make enough time for this instructional leadership work, we develop a permanent sense of frustration, and we tell ourselves, if only I could spend more time on instructional leadership, my school would be improving faster and I'd be more effective. And I'm guessing that this frustration, which is nearly universal in our profession, is part of what prompted you to sign up for this program. We all want to do high-level, high-impact work and spend less time bogged down in the details of school management. But a funny thing happens to our management work when we grow as instructional leaders. We discover, by spending more time in classrooms, exactly what management work we can do that will make the greatest difference for our students and teachers. We may not actually spend less time overall on management, but the work we do spend our time on will be the right work, and it'll make a greater difference. And sometimes that management work will have even a bigger impact on student learning than the feedback that we provide to teachers. When you're sitting in the office, you're a target for other people's priorities. Policymakers, community members, and everyone on campus knows where to find you so they can give you their priorities. But they don't know what needs to be done to make your school a better place. Figuring that out is your job. In his classic 1973 book, The Nature of Managerial Work, organizational scholar Henry Mintzberg argued that managerial work is, by definition, whatever managers actually do. That sounds obvious, but he was pushing back against the idea that some activities, like serving as a figurehead and spokesperson for the organization, aren't really management work. Mintzberg said, that distinction is silly. If managers do it, it's management work. Today, the terminology has shifted, and nobody wants to be called a manager. We want to be called leaders. But Mintzberg's point still holds. If we're instructional leaders, whatever we do is, by definition, instructional leadership. The myth in our profession is that working on the budget, or hiring, or doing purchase orders, or dealing with safety problems on campus is management work and not instructional leadership. So we push ourselves to get away from all of that work so we can spend more time getting into classrooms and giving teachers feedback. And if we're successful, we often find that effective instructional leadership generates even more management work. If I spend time in a teacher's classroom and then realize I need to set that teacher up with some professional development or coaching support, I then have to take off the instructional leader's hat and put on the manager's hat so I can fill out a budget request and coordinate the support that I've discovered and decided that that teacher needs. And that's not what we thought was going to happen, is it? We thought, I'll go into that teacher's classroom, see how they're doing, and help them out with a few pointers. I'll be an instructional leader, and I'll make a direct difference in student learning by giving the teacher feedback. Heck, I might even stand up and teach part of the lesson if there's a strategy that I can model for the teacher. But feedback and instructional leadership don't usually work that way. Often, we show up in a classroom and we're not sure what to do. We're not sure what to say. We think we're supposed to know the moment we walk in the door, but we don't. Helping teachers improve is complicated. And to sort through that complexity, we need to engage in a leadership practice that hasn't been given enough respect in our profession, conversation. Module 1 is all about the power of conversation between instructional leaders and the professionals we work with. Too often, the idea of conversation gets reduced to a one-way transfer of quote-unquote feedback from administrators to teachers. But I believe conversation can be much more. Conversation is at the heart of effective leadership because it's one of the best ways to learn what's happening in your school and what action you need to take to bring about improvement. Conversation is especially powerful when it's coupled with firsthand observation in classrooms. We'll talk about how to make time for that in Module 2. But for now, we need to get clear on exactly how conversation functions in the high-performance instructional leadership model. We also need to clarify some misconceptions about feedback, which is probably the most widely misunderstood and misused process in our profession. Feedback can be powerful, but it doesn't work the way we've been led to believe. So if you felt like you were supposed to be providing more and better feedback to your teachers, but never really felt like it was hitting home and truly making a difference, you've come to the right place. If you felt like teachers are resistant to your feedback, or on the other hand, that they're just agreeing with you so the conversation can be over quickly, then Module 1 is a great place to start. So again, welcome to the High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification Program. I'm truly excited about the journey that you're on right now, and I can't wait to hear from you. First, I'd like to have your input. What are your goals for this program? What prompted you to sign up? And what outcomes are you hoping to achieve in your leadership and in your school? Use the survey form below to let me know, and when you're done, I'll see you in the next section. What is feedback? I believe it's one of the most misunderstood concepts in our entire profession, something we almost universally get wrong as instructional leaders. As a new principal, I thought my job was to go around to classrooms, observe teachers, and give them feedback so that they could get better. I was required to do this in the formal observation process, and I figured I should do as many walkthroughs or informal visits as possible too. That's what I had been taught, and I'm guessing you've picked up on the same message throughout your career. But I quickly discovered that giving good feedback is actually pretty tough. And because it's tough, it's also rare. I could get into classrooms whenever I wanted, and I could observe teachers teaching and talk with them about what they saw, but that didn't always result in effective feedback. And at first, I thought it was just me. I was a new principal, and I hadn't taught a lot of the grades or subjects that I was observing. I'd been a middle school science teacher. So while I could hold my own in the upper elementary grades and with the science curriculum, I barely knew the first thing about kindergarten or literacy or anything else that we taught in my K-5 school. So I thought it would get easier to give good feedback as my expertise grew. Once I'd been through the same curriculum trainings as teachers, and I'd spent enough time in classrooms to know what good instruction looked like at each grade level, I figured I'd be able to show up in any class, anytime, and give good feedback on the spot. And maybe you've learned the same format I did. I don't know of any book that teaches this method or any research that's been done to back it up, but I somehow got the impression that I should be using the feedback sandwich. You've probably been on the receiving end of the feedback sandwich, either in your professional life or perhaps from a friend or family member. Here's how the feedback sandwich works. If you want to give effective feedback, you want the teacher to hear you, so first you give a compliment. Then, once you've buttered them up, they'll be more open to the constructive criticism, the meat of the sandwich, the suggestion for how they can improve. And then, so you can end on a high note, you give them one more compliment. And that's the feedback sandwich. Compliment, suggestion, compliment. It's not based on any research that I'm aware of, but it's part of the folklore of instructional leadership that gets passed around in our profession. But I often found that the feedback sandwich just plain didn't work. I'd observe in a great teacher's class, and I wouldn't be able to come up with any suggestions for them, at least without getting really picky. There might be room for improvement, but off the top of my head, I wouldn't know what to suggest. And since most of the teachers I worked with were outstanding, this happened all the time. So I could leave only compliments, or I could nitpick and find a suggestion, but I didn't really like either of those options. Even the compliments were hard to come up with, because you can only say, your lesson plans were organized and your kids were on task, so many times without it starting to ring hollow. So I thought, well, maybe the feedback sandwich is a better fit for average or below average teachers who have more to work on. So I'll just have conversations with my great teachers and I'll see what I can learn from them, and then I'll save the feedback sandwich for those teachers who have a lot more room for improvement. But when I tried it with more mediocre teachers, the feedback sandwich fell flat for different reasons. The compliments didn't always seem genuine because, honestly, they weren't always genuine. I was just looking for something nice to say. And even worse, sometimes the teacher would fixate on the compliments and ignore my suggestions for improvement. Even when I got it exactly right and got the teacher to focus on what they really needed to hear, I had the feeling that my feedback was missing the forest for the trees. I could give teachers pointers on what in their lesson they could have done better, but that wasn't usually the real issue, and the feedback sandwich format wasn't suited to addressing those deeper challenges. For example, one day I was observing a math lesson, and the warm-up activity took forever. Students were sharing their approaches to answering a math problem, and the teacher just let it drag on and on for about half of the class period. I was able to come up with a couple of compliments for my feedback sandwich, but when it came to making a suggestion for improvement, I realized that the issue wasn't that the warm-up took too long. As I sat in the classroom and saw the teacher struggling to get through the rest of the period, I realized that the problem was much deeper, a complete lack of planning and preparation. So I had a choice. I could use the feedback sandwich and awkwardly try to wrap my suggestion inside two compliments, or I could take a different approach. I realized in that moment that I didn't really want to treat what I was about to say to the teacher as a suggestion because it wasn't. It was a non-negotiable expectation. You must plan your lessons in advance. It's not acceptable to wing it and hope for the best, and it felt incredibly artificial to try and pad that expectation with compliments like you're great at thinking on your feet and being flexible. So I didn't. I focused on what needed to change. And I realized that day that the feedback sandwich isn't all it's cracked up to be. The more I looked and looked for the right situations to use it in, the more I realized it's hardly ever the right approach. So I had to ask myself, what is feedback really, and how is it supposed to work? Is feedback when I show up and tell someone what I think? I think a good gut check for leadership practices is to try them on your spouse, or ask your spouse to try them on you, and see how they feel. When you take professional roles out of the mix and just think about the way you're interacting with another human being, you can gain a lot of clarity. So if you're not convinced yet that the feedback sandwich is a dumb idea, try it on someone you love. Give them a compliment, and then a suggestion, and then another compliment, and do this the next 3 times you speak with them, and see what happens. I'm willing to bet that it won't be a great experience. It'll feel awkward and artificial, and even passive-aggressive. Now, if you want your employees to tolerate your being awkward and artificial and passive-aggressive, you can probably get them to go along with that, because hey, you're the boss. But if you want to have good professional relationships with your staff, and if you want to actually make a difference in their practice, I think there's a better way to provide feedback. So how is feedback supposed to work? Let's map out a theory of action for it. This is a process that I teach in depth in our Instructional Leadership Intensive program on strategic planning. Really though, it's pretty simple. All we have to do is describe what's supposed to happen step by step, cause and effect, and under what conditions. If I think about how feedback is supposed to work, it's supposed to involve me seeing something in the classroom and getting an idea of what I can say to the teacher that will lead to reflection and growth. Now, we all have blind spots about ourselves, so it shouldn't be too hard to notice something that the teacher hasn't already realized about their practice, especially since classrooms are such busy and complex places. But if I come up with a suggestion for the teacher, what are the odds that the teacher hasn't already considered my idea? Well, if it's an experienced teacher, the odds are good that they've already thought of it and rejected it, perhaps years ago. And I'll tell you, as a new principal, I was terrified of this possibility. I was worried that I'd suggest something and then the teacher would think, "What an idiot! Where does he come up with this stuff?" And this fear led me to the first insight about feedback, that feedback must tell the other person something they don't already know. Feedback that isn't new information isn't feedback. In fact, I realized suggestions and outside criticism aren't feedback at all, because feedback involves feeding something back to the teacher. So I thought about the origins of the term, and I realized that feedback is an audio or electrical term. If you're a musician and you hold your microphone too close to a speaker, you get one kind of feedback. That's just amplified noise. But the other kind of feedback is really important, the kind of feedback you get from a monitor speaker. A monitor is a speaker pointed toward the musician so they can hear how they sound and make adjustments as needed. And the same is true for feedback on teaching. It's about feeding information about the teacher's practice back to the teacher so they can self-monitor and make decisions about how to improve. I think this decision is much more accurate, but it also presents a problem for us as instructional leaders because it means we can't dictate the direction of the conversation. When teachers are asking for feedback, they could be asking for one of several things other than suggestions for improvement. First, they could just be looking for validation or encouragement. I found that when the best teachers were asking for feedback, this is often all they were looking for, a nod from me that they were on the right track, which of course they almost always were. Second, they may want an answer to a very specific question about their practice. Again, extremely good teachers tend to be the ones who ask for this kind of feedback. For example, I once had a request from an outstanding teacher to come and observe her using a new strategy for teaching decoding because she wanted to know whether she was doing one part of that strategy exactly the way she'd been taught in a recent training. Finally, teachers could just genuinely want any suggestions for improvement that we have to offer. I've had this request a few times, but my sense is that it's probably more a way for the teacher to show that they're committed to growth and to signal to the boss that they're easy to work with. Generally, people don't seek out random suggestions or criticism. Again, ask yourself, do people do that in your personal life? Does your teenager or your spouse say, "Hey, do you have any suggestions for improvement for me today?" Probably not, and you probably don't either. That's not to say that feedback isn't a real and powerful force for improvement in schools. It certainly can be. But a lot of what we've been doing as a profession in the name of feedback isn't really feedback. And in fact, feedback really only works under very specific circumstances, which we'll explore later in this module. For now, I want to leave you with this idea. As powerful as feedback can be, conversation can be even more powerful as a force for improvement. So I want to challenge you right now to start to let go of the idea that feedback is your number one obligation as an instructional leader. Anytime you think you're supposed to be providing feedback, make a switch in your mind, and instead substitute conversation for feedback. And you'll find that conversation does a much better job of helping teachers reflect and grow and helping us as leaders gather the information we need for making effective decisions. But there's one more thing. Conversation has an incredibly powerful side effect that feedback doesn't have. Conversation builds relationships. In fact, all human relationships are built, first and foremost, on conversation. Think about that, and I'll see you in the next section. Let's talk about the assumptions behind the traditional idea of feedback in our profession. As we've discussed, a lot of what we do in the name of providing feedback to teachers isn't really feedback. Feedback involves returning information to its source for self-monitoring and improvement. So when we drop in and give teachers unsolicited advice, it's not feedback. Now, you can do that if you want to, but it's likely to work only under very specific circumstances. So, what are those circumstances? When does traditional supervisory feedback really work? To describe those circumstances in detail, I'm going to share with you what I call the medical model of feedback, because it has the same diagnosis and prescription approach you'd expect when you visit the doctor. Let's say you go to the doctor for your annual checkup, and at your appointment, the doctor tells you you need to increase your intake of blueberries. And you think, well, that seems oddly specific, so you ask yourself some questions to figure out whether you're going to take this advice. The first question you might ask is, does the doctor really have the necessary expertise in this area? If the doctor practices internal medicine, you might think, sure, but if the doctor is an orthopedic surgeon, that expertise in another area might not transfer over. And this is a huge challenge we face as instructional leaders. We may have a good general knowledge base about teaching and learning, but we can't be experts in everything. And it should frequently be the case that our teachers know more about what they're teaching than we do. If not, that means we have a hiring and retention problem. I want my Spanish teacher to know more about teaching Spanish than I do. And I want my kindergarten teacher to be better with kindergartners than I am. The second question you might ask when your doctor prescribes a diet high in blueberries is, does the doctor have enough information about me to make a good recommendation? I expect my doctor to look at my chart and review my medical records to make sure I don't have an allergy to blueberries. And if I have to be the one to say, actually, doc, I'm allergic to blueberries, I'm going to be a lot more skeptical of everything else the doctor says. As an instructional leader, if I'm giving advice to a teacher, this means I have to be clear enough on the teacher's abilities and needs to give advice that's appropriate for them. For example, as a former science teacher, I know how important it is to do labs and to get students doing hands-on science, not just read about science in a textbook. But I also know that doing labs requires a certain level of skill in planning and in classroom management. So if I go into a new science teacher's classroom and the kids are doing book work and the class is out of control, I can't just tell the teacher to start doing labs. Having a more engaging, hands-on experience for kids might make them less likely to misbehave, so it's not that my advice is wrong overall. It's just not what that teacher needs in that moment. If you have a class full of kids who aren't used to listening to their teacher or following directions, doing labs is going to be dangerous. And if the teacher isn't used to planning and preparing for labs, they're going to be a disaster. So as an instructional leader, I need not only expertise in the area I'm giving advice on, but also knowledge of the person I'm giving advice to, so I can make sure it's the right advice for them. Third, if your doctor prescribes a diet high in blueberries, before spending any time examining you or talking with you, you'll probably conclude that the advice isn't worth very much. And we know this as instructional leaders, right? If we're going to help teachers improve, we need to spend time in their classrooms and really see what's going on. So the third requirement is a thorough examination of the situation. Fourth, we then need to make an accurate diagnosis, which, if we've met the other conditions so far, shouldn't be a problem. But we need to be sure we're finding the root cause and not just addressing a symptom. For example, if I'm visiting that out-of-control science classroom, one of the symptoms might be that students are off task and talking. But the root cause is that the teacher hasn't established good routines and procedures. That's the part we need to address first. Fifth, I need to come up with the correct prescription to address the root cause. Telling this teacher to start doing labs tomorrow without solid routines and procedures in place is going to be a disaster. Similarly, if I'm at the doctor and my real problem is that I have undiagnosed type 1 diabetes and I need to start getting insulin injections, eating blueberries isn't going to help. The diagnose and prescribe approach has to be tailored to the specific situation of the client in order to be the right diagnosis and prescription. But there's one more condition, and that is follow through and follow up. If I realize that this science teacher needs to establish better routines and procedures, I can't just write that on a little note and then leave. Simply telling the teacher to establish better routines and procedures isn't likely to help. We need to see it through, just as a doctor would refer me to additional training and support and make sure that I was following through on managing my condition after making a diagnosis. So if we're going to provide traditional feedback to teachers, which is really unsolicited advice that we believe they need to hear in order to improve, these are the conditions that we've established: sufficient expertise, background knowledge about the individual, thorough examination of the situation, accurate diagnosis, correct prescription, and follow through and follow up. If all of those factors are in place, traditional feedback can work. And if you've read books by the folks at Uncommon Schools, like Doug Limov's Get Better Faster, A 90-Day Plan for Coaching New Teachers, or Paul Bambrick-Santoyo's Leverage Leadership, A Practical Guide for Building Exceptional Schools, you know how much potential there is in helping teachers improve with this model, which I'll refer to as the medical model. However, I want to be very clear that the high-performance instructional leadership model is very different from the medical model. The medical model is a great fit for schools with large numbers of new teachers. In fact, you might say that Uncommon Schools and similar organizations are perfectly designed to help large numbers of new teachers develop their skills quickly through an intensive approach that's heavy on traditional feedback. The limitation of the medical model is that it requires a large gap in expertise. So if you want to use the medical model with an experienced, skilled professional teacher, your expertise in their specific area has to be outstanding. In fact, there's probably only one area where you have that level of expertise. For example, if you were a literacy coach and then became an elementary principal, you probably have more than enough expertise to help nearly all of your teachers get dramatically better at literacy instruction using the medical model for feedback. Or if you were a high school calculus teacher and then became a math coach and then became an administrator, you may be able to help your math teachers using the medical model. But as a general approach to instructional leadership, the medical model has a built-in fatal flaw. Your teachers will outgrow you, which is a good thing. But when they do, you can't continue to use the medical model without holding them back. The medical model is a way of picking the low-hanging fruit of improvement. And if you look at the rubrics in books like Get Better Faster or Leverage Leadership, you'll see that they're ultra-specific about how to go from bad at teaching to good at teaching. But you'll also realize that your great teachers are doing hardly any of what's in those rubrics. The medical model is perfect for helping teachers move from bad to good, but terrible for helping teachers move from good to great. When teachers become true professionals, they no longer need the scaffolding provided by intense supervision and directive feedback. And in fact, that scaffolding becomes restrictive. So it either needs to go away, or these skilled teachers need to start working with someone else who has deeper expertise in their area. And at times, I've been able to find that expertise, but it's almost always from the outside, and it comes at a pretty high price. For example, we had outside trainers work with some of our best teachers in new curriculum areas to help build capacity internally by helping those teachers become true experts. But that's pretty rare. Usually, the medical model just isn't appropriate for great teachers. So why doesn't this appear to be a problem in a lot of the schools that have become the champions of the medical model as a general approach to instructional leadership? Well, no one really wants to say this, but it's because of turnover. Uncommon schools and similar organizations have an incredibly high rate of teacher turnover and an incredibly small number of teachers who stay for 5, 10, 15, or even 20 years. And because that's their reality, they've optimized their system for supporting these teachers, and they've largely ignored the needs of highly skilled veteran teachers who are ready to move from good to great. And make no mistake, this is a calculated choice. If you have a school with very few strong teachers and a large number of struggling novice teachers, it makes complete sense to focus on helping the struggling teachers move from bad to good. In fact, it makes sense to systematize your approach to helping teachers move from bad to good. But we have to realize that great teachers are going to find it too restrictive. So if you're using the medical model, it's absolutely essential to differentiate your approach and switch to another model once a teacher has moved from bad to good. If you don't, here's what'll happen. You'll get more of what your system is optimized for. If you're the kind of instructional leader who's great at moving teachers from bad to good, but restrictive to good teachers and ineffective at moving them from good to great because of that inflexibility, what are you going to end up with? Probably a fair number of good teachers, but almost no great teachers. And as your good teachers grow, they're going to leave. And who are you going to replace them with? Overwhelmingly, novice teachers who are going to struggle. So choosing the medical model as a general approach to instructional leadership is something of a trap. When you treat everyone as if they're an unskilled novice, guess what you get? An endless supply of unskilled novices. The great teachers chafe at the restrictions they're forced to work under, and they leave, and they're replaced by more unskilled novices. And again, this is a calculated decision on the part of some organizations. If you can reliably get good results from novice teachers in a short period of time, that may be easier than holding on to great teachers. But in most schools, I'm going to guess that your situation is a little different. I'm going to guess that most of your teachers do want to stick around and do want to become highly skilled professionals. And the medical model, as powerful as it is for helping teachers move from bad to good, just isn't going to take them from good to great. But the high-performance instructional leadership model can, because it's based on something simpler, more universal, and more powerful. Conversation. What I'd like you to do now is think about your teachers and think about whether the medical model is a good fit for some of them. With which teachers can you achieve all six conditions for effective feedback? And again, those are sufficient expertise, background knowledge about the individual, a thorough examination of the situation, accurate diagnosis, correct prescription, and follow through and follow up. I'm hoping that it's a small number of teachers, because applying the medical model is incredibly labor-intensive for you, the instructional leader. When it works, it works. And if the conditions are right, I don't want to discourage you from using the medical model. So make a list for yourself right now. Which teachers would benefit from that kind of intensive supervision and support? But just as importantly, which teachers are ready for something bigger and better? Which teachers are ready to go from good to great? Helping teachers grow through conversation is our focus throughout the rest of this module. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. How can we change teacher practice? And what is it that we're actually trying to change when we provide feedback, or better yet, have conversations with teachers? The dominant view in our profession seems to be that teaching is mostly about technique, about the observable actions that teachers take during class. Think about the way we evaluate teachers. We watch them teach, and we talk about ways they could improve what they do during class. But some of the most important work teachers do isn't directly observable, either because it happens behind the scenes, like planning lessons and collaborating with colleagues, or because it's cognitive work. This fact, that teaching is largely cognitive work, has been obscured in recent years by all the emphasis on the observable behaviors, the techniques of teaching. Part of the blame for this lies with us, the instructional leaders. As we've taken on more responsibility for instructional leadership, we've emphasized the observable aspects of teaching because they're more accessible to us. All we have to do is watch teachers teaching, and we can get a sense of their actions and the techniques that they're using, but getting at teacher thinking is more difficult, so we've shied away from it. We've also been discouraged from focusing on teacher thinking in recent years by the multitude of resources that use the medical model. Book after book after book, cataloging the 15 or 27 or 39 essential techniques or fundamental strategies or core practices of teaching have been published, and we've eaten it all up. We've made these books bestsellers because they've told us how to diagnose and prescribe, how to see what's wrong with teachers' teaching and what to tell them so they can make it better. Parker Palmer says in his legendary book, The Courage to Teach, that technique is what teachers use until the real teacher arrives. By focusing so much on technique, on the observable actions teachers take in the classroom, we're actually preventing the real teacher from showing up, because real teaching is about thinking for yourself and deciding what your students need, not just using a set of techniques. You can see this most clearly in the games we play. For example, we know there's a certain ritual we're supposed to go through in the formal observation process. We have a pre-conference where the teacher shares lesson plans with the administrator, and the administrator can't just say, "Great, looks good to me." No, we have to ask some questions, and not questions that truly prompt reflection or get at teachers' thinking, but just questions that show that we're capable of playing our role. We ask things like, "How do you differentiate for the needs of all students?" Or, "How did you use standards and assessment results in planning this lesson?" Not because we care about the answers, but because we're supposed to ask. And teachers are supposed to be able to answer. As long as they say something acceptable, we've all played the game, and we can get on with our day. We do the same thing after the observation in the post-conference. We ask a few questions like, "How did you think it went?" Or, "What was your evidence of student learning?" But again, we don't really care. We're not interested in the answers because we're not really interested in the questions. They're just part of the game we play. And it's no wonder that almost everyone considers this game a waste of time. But our obsession with technique is visible most clearly during class, when we're observing. What do we look for? What do we make note of? Overwhelmingly, we focus on teacher actions and on technique, and we have very little guidance in how to access teacher thinking. And really, this is understandable. If we focus on technique, we can compare what we see the teacher doing to the techniques we know about, and we can suggest improvements. Again, this is the medical model: diagnose and prescribe. It's pretty easy to change teacher practice if we define teacher practice only as what teachers do. But how on earth do you figure out what and how teachers are thinking, much less change it? This brings us back to the fundamental integration of instructional leadership and management. Often what we need to do to change teacher thinking isn't just tell teachers to use a different technique. It's to provide them with opportunities to expand and refine their thinking. That means that my greatest contribution as an instructional leader may not be in telling a teacher to switch from technique A to technique B, but in noticing that the teacher needs additional professional development to understand when to use techniques A and B and how to execute them skillfully. The false dichotomy between management work and instructional leadership work has reinforced the medical model, because if I'm using the medical model, I don't really have to do much more than tell teachers what to change. But to do this effectively, I have to be the expert. I have to know a lot more than the teacher so I can tell them what to change. And this is usually only the case for new or low-performing teachers. After a few years, virtually all teachers should be better at what they're doing than anyone who's not doing that same work, including us, the instructional leaders. But because we've all bought into the medical model, that's an uncomfortable truth. Teachers are hesitant to assert that they know more about what they're teaching than we do. And we certainly don't want to admit it. So we all agree to play the feedback game. We give feedback on technique, on what we see teachers doing, and we make suggestions for how to do it better. Teachers, for their part, agree to implement our suggestions, but of course, if we haven't done anything to understand or influence their thinking, there's almost no chance those changes will stick. So am I saying that technique doesn't matter or that we shouldn't talk about what we actually see when we're in the classroom? No, not at all. What I'm saying is that teaching is like an iceberg. A lot of it's hidden beneath the surface. Teaching behaviors, what teachers actually do that we can see in the classroom, are just the tip of the iceberg. And if we try to chip away at just that visible part, if we try to change practice without getting at the underlying thinking, we don't know what's really going to change. But there's also a more significant consequence when we fail to see the rest of the iceberg. If we don't acknowledge that teaching is largely cognitive work, and we focus too heavily on the observable techniques teachers are using, we end up with teachers who do the same thing. We end up with teachers who aren't interested in or capable of being true professionals. The medical model can help you take teachers from bad to good, but it's a lot of work for you, and it will never help your teachers grow from good to truly great. Only a true professional can become a great teacher. So what is it that defines a true professional teacher? It's not their skill in using a technique, and it's not the certifications or degrees they hold or their years of experience. What defines a true professional is their locus of professional authority. When someone is just entering the profession at the novice stage, they put their trust in a mentor. For example, the master teacher they do their student teaching with. At this stage, the novice teacher is learning how to do the cognitive work of teaching, but they'll always defer to their mentor as the true source of authority. This makes sense because until you have a certain amount of experience, you aren't ready to make all those decisions on your own, and you need a safe environment to develop that experience. When someone moves out of the novice stage and becomes a full-fledged teacher, they're ready to make their own decisions based on shared expectations. They don't have to run every decision by someone else, but they do need clear guidelines. That's why new teachers on a team will usually defer to the way their team or their school does things, not because they can't make decisions for themselves, but because those shared expectations are the authority. We'll call this the pre-professional stage. Schools where the medical model has really taken off tend to be schools where overwhelmingly the teachers are at one of these first two stages, novice or pre-professional. But even as they gain experience, teachers who work in medical model schools tend to stay at the pre-professional stage because our approach to instructional leadership tends to keep them there. What do I mean by this? If in every interaction with an instructional leader, you're not encouraged to think for yourself, but you're instead pressed to demonstrate how you're using the techniques that are expected of you, how will you ever become a true professional? The answer is by quitting. The only way you can move out of the pre-professional stage is by moving into a new environment where your professionalism will be respected. And this puts high-needs schools in a bit of a bind, at least if the medical model is the only option. In a high-needs school, you can't afford to just assume everyone is a professional and leave them alone. That's why organizations like Uncommon Schools have achieved dramatically better results by setting very clear expectations for technique and ensuring that teachers are using those techniques, because it's better than leaving novices and pre-professionals to their own devices. So I don't fault them for that. But this dynamic creates a real problem when it comes to attracting and retaining a core group of experienced professional teachers. When teachers are at the professional stage, they legitimately trust their own judgment more than the expectations of their school. You can tell a professional teacher, "You must use these techniques in this particular way. It's my way or the highway." And they'll say, "Fine, see you later. Good luck replacing me." And they're right. It'll be very hard to attract true professionals into a school that's designed around the needs of pre-professionals. So obviously, we need a differentiated approach to working with teachers at different stages of their professional growth. But that differentiation doesn't take the form of just letting the best teachers off the hook so that they don't have to follow the same expectations as everyone else. No, the way we differentiate our instructional leadership is to recognize professional teachers as instructional leaders. If their judgment is their source of professional authority, if it's what they trust more than anything else when making instructional decisions, it should also be our source of professional authority. That means a good portion of the time, we should be deferring to the judgment of our best teachers and basing our school-wide expectations on what our best teachers are already doing. In Module 5, we'll talk about how to formalize these shared expectations in your instructional framework. But for now, I'll leave you with this. If you want to change teacher practice, it's not enough to focus on technique. Teaching is cognitive work. And if we want to understand how teachers are approaching this work, observation alone isn't enough. We must engage in conversation to get at teachers' thinking. If you're completing our optional certification, here's your next action step. On the template we've provided, divide your staff into three groups. Novice teachers who treat a mentor as their source of professional authority, pre-professionals who treat shared expectations as their ultimate source of professional authority, and true professionals who view their own professional judgment as their ultimate source of professional authority. We'll do more with this later, but for now, this is just for you. Put each teacher in one of those three categories by listing their name in the appropriate column. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. In this module, we've been exploring the power of professional conversations to help us influence teacher practice. Conversations help us see the whole iceberg of teacher practice, including the cognition, the invisible thinking behind the observable teaching behaviors we see when we visit classrooms. But we've all been in conversations that don't go well. We may want to talk about practice and figure out next steps for the teacher's growth, but we can't do that by ourselves. Teachers do their own growing, and teaching isn't just about using techniques, it's about thinking. And changing thinking isn't easy. It's uncomfortable and even threatening, and there are a number of different ways that teachers can react when they get uncomfortable. What can we do when we sense that a conversation isn't going well, when the teacher is getting defensive or shifting the blame or changing the subject? Later on in this program, I'll be sharing with you my high-performance feedback flow charts, a playbook for keeping conversations on track. In this playbook, we'll work through specific scenarios that you might encounter so that you'll know exactly what to do to keep the conversation focused on practice. So stay tuned for that. For now, we'll start with the core issue. Conversations with teachers tend to go off track because teachers feel threatened. Let's say you're talking with a 20-year veteran teacher and you're asking questions that the teacher has never been asked before. You're asking the teacher to think about their practice in ways they've never encountered. Instead of the games we usually play, like asking, how did you use standards and assessment results in planning this lesson? You're asking real questions that probe the teacher's thinking. And that makes the teacher wonder, what if I don't have the right answers? I thought we were playing the usual game, but this is something different, and I don't know what to say. And this puts the teacher in a very real position of danger. They could lose their job, or at least lose some status, and they'd be crazy not to be concerned about that. It's absolutely in their best interest to steer the conversation away from that threat fast. So there's a good chance that the teacher will try to dodge. They'll change the subject and start talking about district politics, or the kids, or the parents, or the feds, or anything else but their own practice. What do you do when this happens? Do you stop them and say, hey, we're here to talk about you, so let's get back on topic? You could, but remember the iceberg. Teacher practice isn't just what teachers do. It's their thinking beneath the surface that determines what they do. And the same is true of teacher resistance. When someone changes the subject to avoid talking about their own practice, figuring out what's behind that resistance is going to make a bigger difference on their practice than addressing it directly. So I want to challenge you to respond to resistance with curiosity. If a teacher doesn't want to talk about how they're using the new curriculum, you don't have to drag them kicking and screaming into that conversation. If you sense the resistance, step back and try another approach. And it's completely fine to end the conversation without a resolution. You're not playing the old games anymore, so it's okay to walk away without a clear action plan. This gives you the freedom to inquire and figure out what's really going on. Sometimes you'll figure it out right away and you'll know just what to do. For example, I remember having a conversation with a teacher about how our new writing curriculum was going for her. And I knew she wasn't exactly thrilled about it. She hemmed and hawed for a bit, and pretty quickly, she admitted that she'd actually lost her copy of the teacher's guide. Now, was there more beneath the surface that we needed to address? Yes, absolutely. And there were specific actions that I needed to take to build her confidence with the new curriculum. But first things first, she needed another copy of the teacher's guide. You're going to find, as you engage in these conversations, that helping teachers improve isn't as simple as giving them random suggestions. Teacher practice is complex, and it takes multiple conversations to figure out what the rest of that iceberg looks like. Only when you've done that can you provide the support and accountability necessary for that improvement to take place. Right now, you probably have several different teachers on your mind, each with different ways of resisting talking about their practice. What I want to encourage you to do next is not to go for the big, difficult changes. Instead, focus on having more conversations. Focus on frequency. Leave those conversations open-ended, without a strong sense of closure, if that's what needs to happen. As we wrap up Module 1, I'm going to leave you with a challenge to actually get into classrooms without talking to the teacher, so stay tuned for that. Then in module 2, we'll talk about getting started with a regular, consistent habit of visiting classrooms and talking with teachers and how to make time for it on a daily basis. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in the next section. Congratulations on reaching the end of module 1. I want to commend you for taking action and for putting in the work. We've been through a lot of big ideas about the power of conversation in this module, and I'm sure you're eager to put them into practice. But before you start engaging in evidence-based conversations with teachers, I want to challenge you to start small, because we've got a lot more to talk about. In my book, Now We're Talking, 21 Days to High-Performance Instructional Leadership, I share a game plan for your first 3 cycles of classroom visits. See, if you just start showing up in classrooms and taking notes, it's going to be a little bit jarring for teachers. They might be happy to see you, and they might be glad to have a chance to talk with you about their practice, but probably more than a few people will be a little bit alarmed. So here's what I want you to do. Within the next week of school, I want you to visit every classroom for a few minutes. Now, if you share evaluation duties with other administrators, visit just the teachers that you supervise. For most people, that's going to be fewer than 40 teachers, so you can absolutely get around to everyone within 5 school days. But what I don't want you to do yet is worry about having conversations or collecting evidence, not for your first cycle. For now, just drop by every classroom with a friendly look on your face and stay for a few minutes. Pay attention, but don't take any notes. Say something nice before you leave if you can, but don't try to give feedback or engage the teacher in conversation. You can leave him a little note if you want, but nothing heavy. Your goal in this first round of visits is just to get started and to make it a pleasant experience for everyone. The one thing I do want you to make sure you do is keep track of your visits. So print off a staff roster and check off each teacher as you visit their room. You'll also want to note the date so you can visit teachers in the same order next time. If you've already completed this first round of visits and you've already developed the habit of visiting 3 classrooms per day, keep going with that, the way I describe in Now We're Talking, 21 Days to High Performance Instructional Leadership. But if you're just getting started, use the next 5 school days to visit every teacher you supervise. Just pop in for a few minutes, make a good impression, and that's it. And that's it for Module 1. I'm Justin Bader, and I'll see you in Module 2, where we'll talk about high performance habits for getting into classrooms.